Hello, and welcome to Conversations in the World of Allergy, a podcast produced by the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. I'm your host, Dave Stukas. I'm a board-certified allergist and immunologist and serve as the social media medical editor for the Academy. Our podcast series will use different formats to interview thought leaders in the world of allergy and immunology. This podcast is not intended to provide any individual medical advice to our listeners. We do hope that our conversations provide evidence-based information. Any questions pertaining to one's own health should always be discussed with their personal physician. The Find an Allergist search engine on the Academy website is a useful tool to locate a listing of board-certified allergists in your area. Finally, use of this audio program is subject to the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Terms of Use Agreement, which you can find at www.aaaai.org. Today's edition of our Conversations in the World of Allergy podcast series focuses on a very hot topic, and it's intended for allergists, medical professionals, and really anybody who lives with or knows somebody who has food allergies. And I think you're going to find this to be a very useful conversation. It's very exciting. We are pleased to welcome Dr. Robert Wood to today's episode. Dr. Wood is a professor of pediatrics at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and chief of the Udo Wood Division of Allergy and Immunology at Johns Hopkins Children's Center in Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Wood is an internationally acclaimed expert in pediatric food allergy and has led an extensive career as a physician scientist. He is a past president of the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology and serves as the study co-chair for the OutMatch study, which is what we're going to be discussing today. Dr. Wood, thank you so much for taking time to join us and welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Dave. It's a pleasure.
Now, I think this is going to be a great conversation. It's a very exciting topic for many of our listeners, and I know people are eager to learn more. Perhaps we can begin by just having you describe what omalizumab is and its mechanism of action.
Sure. So omalizumab is an injectable medication, an antibody that is designed to block the IgE antibodies that a person with allergy makes. So essentially what we're looking for the drug to do is to sop up the IgE that will make them have reactions if they're exposed, in this case, to the food that they're allergic to, so that food exposures are less likely to cause any sort of reaction and hopefully even more likely to prevent severe anaphylactic kind of reactions.
How long have we used omalizumab in clinical practice, and what are some of the other conditions that it's approved to treat?
Well, one of the great things about studying this drug is that there's a long history of use. So the first approval came for allergic asthma in 2003, and we know now with extensive data from around the world a lot about the safety of the drug, and that actually made doing the study somewhat easier because for a new indication, you often have to be exploring new safety data, which we certainly looked at, but we pretty much knew how this drug was going to behave.
And in addition to allergic asthma, are there other indications that omalizumab has
been
used?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. So it's been approved for about a decade for chronic hives and for the last 5 or 6 years for nasal polyps and chronic rhinosinusitis.
Okay. And you mentioned this wonderful long track record of safety as well as efficacy. Are there any major adverse effects that people should be aware of when prescribing or being treated with omalizumab?
There are. And the principal adverse reaction that actually has a specific warning on the product label is that a small number of patients have been reported to experience allergic, even anaphylactic reactions to the injection itself. And those estimates range between 1 in 500 individuals and 1 in 1,000 individuals. So while not common, it is still a risk that all patients need to be aware of.
Okay. You know, I've always wondered this, and we may not have the answer. Do we have any idea why a treatment that treats allergic reactions may cause an allergic reaction in somebody?
Well, I think, we've learned from different drugs, especially injectable products, that there is probably for that individual one of the inactive ingredients in the product that has led to an adverse or allergic reaction. The specific component, though, is not clear, and we can say that there might even be more than one inactive component of the Xolair product that people might react to.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And as you mentioned, thankfully, it's quite rare. Well, let's move into the bulk of today's conversation. And can you tell us a little bit about why the OutMatch study was designed in the first place? Is there an incomplete understanding of how omalizumab may impact food allergies?
Yeah, it's a long story, and I think one of the messages that became more and more clear was that from a lot of small studies, a lot of which were really using omalizumab along with oral immunotherapy, there was a very strong sense that omalizumab could help food allergic patients. The reality, though, was that all these small studies mean very little, virtually nothing to the FDA in terms of getting a new product approved, or in this case, a new indication for an existing product. And we set about to actually do the study that would eventually, we hoped, lead to an FDA indication for omalizumab for the treatment of food allergy.
Okay.
The longer story of this, and you can cut this if you don't need it, but the longer story of this is that we had the opportunity when the Consortium of Food Allergy Research was renewed with me as principal investigator in 2017 to explore new study ideas. And the study idea that had the greatest appeal, the greatest enthusiasm and excitement from the investigators of the consortium, as well as the NIH, was this approach to using Xolair potentially as monotherapy for food allergy. And it so happened that at that point in time, the companies, Genentech and Novartis, were very excited about actually studying this indication, but very reluctant to take on a study that has so much risk as this one, the risk being not the drug, but the multiple food challenges that people were exposed to. And we ended up having this remarkable collaboration between the NIH, COFAR, and industry that really is a model that the NIH is trying to use going forward, in that this was NIH supported, with NIH as the official sponsor of the study, but with real contributions from industry in terms of both funding and scientific input on the protocol and the results.
I think that's fascinating, and if it's okay with you, we will definitely not cut that from our our interview. Do you have a sense of, you know, the time from initial conception of the idea to actually getting the study underway? Is this something that happened over the course of a couple of weeks, or did this take a couple of years?
Yeah, it is a slow process, and I'm going to come back around to the end and say we actually got things done fairly quickly to go all the way from an idea to an FDA approval. But the reality was that we had our first meeting in June of 2017. We started the study in August of 2019. And we were actually going really well for the next 8 or 9 months. And then we had something called COVID hit, which led to really dramatic interruption in research studies. But even this one more than others, because it's not a study you can do remotely. The participants and their families and the caretakers needed to be meeting face-to-face typically every 2 weeks over the course of the study. We did a real bump in the road with COVID, but thankfully we were able to overcome that. And one of the unique things about the study, Dave, is that at the point that COVID hit and our research units were shut down, we had 42 patients, mostly children, getting injections. And all 42 returned and had to start over. Some of whom had been on injections for as long as 7 months, had to start over, and they all came back.
Wow. Boy, we all owe those folks a lot of gratitude. That's amazing. The title of the study and the protocol are both fascinating to me for many reasons. We're going to talk about some details in a second. OUTMATCH stands for Omalizumab as monotherapy and as adjunct therapy to multi-allergen OIT in food allergic participants. So, Dr. Wood, I have to ask you, we've seen some pretty unique acronyms for some pivotal clinical trials that have been published in recent years. Is there a marketing team that comes up with these, or do you all just kind of sit in a room trying to come up with something catchy?
Well, I will say that some people are much better at this than others. So I'm very good at writing the long title, describing what the study is going to do. I'm really terrible at finding these acronyms. But thankfully, there are some very smart, clever people sitting around the table. And we start throwing letters together and throwing things out. And we came up with an OUTMATCH, which really seemed to fit and has worked well.
Yeah, that's great. So you mentioned the importance of really coming up with a study to try to gain FDA approval, but can you describe the process when you actually determine the study design for a clinical trial such as this? And if you could maybe touch upon why it's so important to develop precise inclusion exclusion criteria as well as clearly defined study endpoints.
Yeah, so the every study that is designed needs ideally to have very precise inclusion exclusion criteria and study endpoints. Some hit the mark closer than others, but when we're talking about a phase three trial, and a phase three trial in this case and in most cases, meaning a trial that is geared toward obtaining a label for that drug, there are some very special requirements, not all of them explicitly related, but that the FDA really expects to have in hand to be comfortable that that study as designed could lead, if the results pan out the way we were hoping they would, to a label for the treatment of food allergy. And that meant, as you mentioned, very specific inclusion exclusion criteria, very specific endpoints, a primary endpoint, and then some key secondary endpoints. Another great collaboration, even though it's dreaded at some levels, another great collaboration is with the FDA and investigators. We sat in a face-to-face meeting before the study started to really hammer out some of the details and to hear their concerns about what we were lacking in our study protocol when they think about what it may take them a few years later to actually say, you've accomplished what we needed to see and you have the label, or we're sorry, but you really didn't have the sample size we suggested, or even something more minor like we disagree with your primary endpoint.
I think that's really interesting and important for our audience to hear you describe. Out of curiosity, was there any turnover in the conversations with the personnel at the FDA at the time that you were designing the study with when it went up for approval? I'm just curious.
There certainly were, in our world, 4 years is a long time. The answer is yes. These FDA conversations are done with a group from the FDA with who all seem to have enough expertise to carry the project forward. The main person from the FDA who oversaw this process was Kelly Stone. I don't think Kelly was actually at the initial meeting. I think he arrived at the FDA shortly after that.
Well, Outmatch has three separate study stages, which I really am so fascinated by. Can you start by just explaining stage one of the study, including the intervention that was used and the endpoints that were evaluated?
Sure. So phase one is the simplest part of the three-part study. And it's simple because it is a standard double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized trial. So potential participants were screened, and the screening required doing food challenges to peanut. Everyone had to be allergic to peanut, and then two other foods. And those foods could include milk, egg, wheat, cashew, walnut, or hazelnut. And they had to be highly allergic to these foods. And it turned out to be, not surprisingly, somewhat difficult, even though we see lots of patients with multiple food allergies. People who really fit these criteria are really out on the more extreme of the world of food allergy patients. Once they qualified, based on their initial testing and food challenges, they were randomized 2-to-1, two-thirds of patients on active drug, one-third on placebo. They were given a dose of Xolair obtained from a dosing algorithm with which they were going to get injections either every 2 weeks or every 4 weeks. Everyone got those injections for the next 16 to 20 weeks, after which they went through another set of food challenges. And that is the primary outcome for stage one. Did omalizumab as monotherapy proved to be superior to placebo in changing the threshold for reaction to peanut and two other foods.
And when you discuss high, you mentioned you had to have highly allergic participants. How was that determined? Was it based upon an IgE level or the dose that they reacted to during the initial challenge? Can you tell us some more?
Yeah, so there were specific criteria related to, say, having an IgE level above 6, having a skin test above 5 millimeters, but the real entry criteria related to the food challenge at baseline. And we ended up using two different inclusion criteria for a variety of reasons, but for peanut, they had to be reacting with dose-limiting symptoms at 100 milligrams, which would be 144 milligrams of cumulative peanut, while for the other foods, they had to react to 300 milligrams or less, and that would be a total of 444. The main reason it went that way is that we had to screen 452 patients to find the 180 that got randomized. And we really recognize that if we set these ultra, ultra strict entry criteria that we have for peanut for the other foods, we would probably still be recruiting next year for this, just for this stage one. And the other part of that is we actually assigned different endpoints to define success for peanut versus the other foods. And that's something that we honestly probably didn't need to do, because it turned out that the reacting dose for all six foods was about the same. So we were not seeing that many patients, you know, enter the study that, that were much less reactive than the peanut side of the equation. But in the end, that is how it was done. And the greatest difficulty in doing this is really the amount of work that we are expecting from the families and the children. Because doing all of this is really a massive amount of work that some people, just from the standpoint of their busy life schedules, couldn't participate, even though they wanted to.
And for our listeners who may not be familiar, when you say 100 milligrams of peanut protein, can you give us an equivalent of, like, what does that mean in regards to a commercial food or a peanut kernel or something like that?
Yeah, no, sure. And that's something we you know, try to point out in our papers and slides and things. So there's 250 to 300 milligrams of peanut in one peanut kernel. And then just to go forward, to be declared successful, you had to tolerate a 600 milligram dose, or 10,044 cumulatively, and that would be equal to about 4 peanuts.
Okay. You mentioned the dosing chart for omalizumab. Is that similar to how it's dosed for other indications, or is there something special about this?
Well, there's something unique about it, and it's modified based on the asthma dosing algorithm. It includes two things that are different. One of them is using a higher cutoff for total IgE. And this is actually something we should come back and discuss a little bit, because there are some patients who might really benefit from this who may not be eligible because their IgE level is too high. The other thing that's completely unique about this dosing table is that it goes down to 1 year of age. And we felt very fortunate to have the FDA's blessing. It was actually their suggestion to go all the way down to 1 year of age. And there are no approved dosing algorithms for age 5 and below. So this required a modification that was based on a lot of experts in drug pharmacodynamics and some other equations and a few guesses we made to create a dosing chart that went down to 10 kilograms and or 1 year of age.
Let's touch upon what you just mentioned, because I know a lot of us have battled with insurance companies who deny approval for omalizumab for treating allergic asthma because the total IgE falls outside the package insert range and things like that, although there is great evidence that shows that patients can still respond favorably to it even if they have higher total IgE. So can you offer some comments on that as well?
Well, my comments are that I think this is still an unmet need. My comments are that many of these patients are those who might need the drug the most, who would benefit from the drug the most. And historically, they put caps on these IG levels, mostly because of concerns about risk, but they carried over beyond the point at which risk of administering the drug to patients with higher IG levels was really ruled out as a significant concern. And then it became more of a, how do we arrange a study that's going to succeed kind of approach? We don't want to actually do damage to our goal by including people where the drug has really never been studied very carefully. I don't necessarily agree with that. I understood it completely. But what it really means going forward is that additional studies will be needed, I believe, and I think everyone around the table in these discussions agrees, will be to look at patients with IgE levels. As you might have seen, the cutoff for the IG was 1850, which is higher than the asthma cutoffs, but still excludes a significant subset of patients that we see every day in clinic.
Yeah. You mentioned, I believe, 180 participants through stage one and down to the age of 1 year old, 1 year of age. What was the oldest age that was included?
Well, the oldest age that could be included was 55. The oldest age that was included was 28. Ah. And the study was set up with a requirement for a certain number of young children. So we had to have at least 50 participants age 5 and below. We had no trouble doing that. We had 68 age 5 and below. It was open to adults without any specific criteria for how many adults needed to be enrolled. And of our 180 participants, 177 fall into the pediatric range of age 17 and below, and just 3 fall into the adult range of 18 and above.
Okay. You mentioned some of the key inclusion criteria, especially those participants had to have peanut allergy and I believe at least 2 other food allergies. Were there other main inclusion criteria that we should be aware of?
They more fall on the exclusion criteria of making sure that no one could enter the study with less than well-controlled asthma, could not have severe atopic dermatitis, mostly because of phase 2 of the study, they could not have a history of eosinophilic esophagitis. So it really comes down to some significant exclusion criteria. The inclusions were fairly straightforward, and they included skin test IgE, a total Ig that fell in the dosing range, and the food challenge.
And were participants with a history of severe anaphylaxis to their food allergen excluded from participating, or were they eligible?
Well, it's a definition issue here, Dave. The way they were excluded, but severe meant that they had to have had a reaction in the past that had significant neurological compromise or intubation. Mm. And most of our patients had a history of anaphylaxis, many of which, you know, would be considered severe, but not severe enough to be excluded from the study.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I would encourage our listeners, if you're not familiar with some of these inclusion exclusion criteria, well, one, read it for yourself. But two, in my opinion, compare them to some of the other pivotal trials that have been done in regards to oral immunotherapy, epicutaneous immunotherapy, and the like, because these are very similar in many ways. And the specific criteria and definitions are always really important when evaluating what the studies actually look at. The results of the first phase were recently released at the annual American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology meeting in Washington, D.C., and they were pivotal, as you mentioned, in omalizumab gaining FDA approval for the treatment of food allergies, which we are absolutely going to come back to at the end after we discuss some of the details of the study. As you mentioned before, phase one evaluated the eliciting dose of different foods for causing an allergic reaction in participants before and after treatment with omalizumab and compared to those who received placebo. So tell us, what did you find?
So we found major differences, and we were not surprised by them. There are some surprising results, but the fact that omalizumab had a significant effect compared to placebo was something we believed to be true just from the smaller studies that have been done previously. And the main numbers, if we say look at our primary endpoint, which was again the proportion of participants who could tolerate a 600 milligram dose, 1044 cumulative, after being treated with the 16 to 20 weeks of omalizumab. And the answer was that 67% in the omalizumab group achieved that milestone compared to 6.7% in the placebo group. And we found similar differences with the other foods. They were most remarkable for the foods where we had larger numbers of participants, but our key secondary endpoints were milk, egg, and cashew. They all hit that same benchmark, p-value less than 0.0001. And we saw the same results for the other foods like hazelnut and wheat, even though we had a smaller number of participants on those foods.
So just to kind of recap, those who received treatment with omalizumab, the majority of them were able to increase the amount that they could ingest prior to experiencing a reaction prior compared to before they started treatment. Is that an accurate summary?
Yeah, that is accurate. And just to go into the numbers a little bit more, the average starting reaction threshold, the baseline threshold, was 30 milligrams for peanut, 30 milligrams for the other foods except for cashew, where it was just 3 milligrams. So to go from 30 to 600, we do think is a clinically meaningful change in your level of reactivity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We also found that there was sort of a distinction between different populations that we're still trying to sort out. But it turned out that more than half of the population could actually tolerate a lot of peanut. So the median value was 4,044 milligrams. Then there were those who had a less robust response, most of whom still exceeded that 600 milligrams. And then a few that were really still trying to figure out who did not have much response to the drug at all. And that's something we need to be very clear about in terms of how the drug is used and what sort of recommendations, I almost said promises, but we never make promises in food allergy, what sort of recommendations we'll be able to safely make for our patients who are interested in being treated with this drug.
Okay. After the initial 16 to 20 weeks of phase one, where they received treatment, participants then entered an open label extension for 24 additional weeks of treatment. What is an open label extension and why was this included as part of the study design?
Yeah, so the first 60 people that completed stage one went into open label extension. And this was included for two reasons. And one was to see if 16 weeks was long enough to see full effect, whether you'd see a difference between getting 16 weeks and an additional 24 weeks, and whether the treatment is durable, meaning is there sort of an initial response where things begin to fall off subsequently. And what we found in this open label extension was that most participants stayed the same or increased their threshold. There was only a meaningful change with cashew, where it did appear that this additional 6 months of treatment made a true difference in their food challenge reactivity. But for the other foods, we were reassured that longer-term treatment did not have any negative consequences, but only had equal to or better food challenge responses than after the 16 weeks.
And can you just briefly explain, I guess, on a basic level, why that makes sense? So in comparison to, like, say, allergic asthma, do we treat people with allergic asthma with omalizumab for 4 months and say you're good to go, you're done? Or, you know, what have we learned from its use in other conditions?
Well, this is certainly unique. But what we've learned, I think, number one, is that the drug is largely very safe, in that, you know, takes in many ways longer term exposure where we can start to say those things. And we do think there are some patients who may choose to use it on a short term basis, but it's really meant to be prescribed more for longer term maintenance. And we'll come back and talk, I think, a little about, you know, who is an ideal candidate for this or not. You know, are certainly patients with urticaria who seem better after 4 months and want to stop, and it can happen. In this case, the shorter-term treatment may just be, you know, getting prepared for some high-level exposures on, you know, a longer trip or something like that. But the overall label, you know, will read, you know, for protection against small accidental exposures and really thought to be more of a longer-term maintenance.
Why do you think that you found some, you know, variations in the results for according to the food that was studied?
So the results were really only different for cashew. And, you know, you and I see patients, we respect cashew allergy. It's really a bad actor. But it was really quite different than the other foods. You know, to have a median baseline reaction threshold of 3 milligrams, about 1/100th of a cashew, is really, to me, pretty remarkable about just how potent that allergen is.
Yeah, I agree. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe the results are available to discuss yet from phase two, but can you describe what's taking place in that part of the outmatch study?
Yes, so phase two is a very different concept. And the concept here is being able to compare longer-term treatment with omalizumab to multi-food OIT, oral immunotherapy. And this is certainly an outstanding question. There have been, you know, lots of studies on single-food OIT, some studies on multi-food OIT, some using omalizumab along with multi-food OIT, but to best inform our field about what they might be advising for our patients, we really thought that a direct comparison would be very useful. So except for the first 60 people who went to the open label extension, the rest of the study population went into stage two. Everyone at the beginning of stage two got 8 weeks of omalizumab open label. They were then randomized to either continue omalizumab for 52 weeks or continue omalizumab for 8 more weeks and then just be on multi-food OIT for the next 44 weeks. Food challenges ensue at the end of this 1 year period where we're going to be able to have a head-to-head comparison, really looking at the efficacy and safety of omalizumab versus multi-food OIT.
So just to clarify, those receiving multi-food OIT, were they receiving treatment with omalizumab while they were getting the OIT, or was that discontinued prior to starting that?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's very confusing. So the answer is that they got open-label omalizumab for 8 weeks before they started treatment. And 8 weeks after they started treatment. And that's sort of an idea of how we might use this in clinical practice if we just wanted to get OIT off the ground more smoothly, where somebody might not need to be on it long term, could potentially, and it's been shown to reduce reactions, especially with dose buildup that happens at the beginning of OIT. So that's really the idea behind it, is to after that time, the multi-food OIT was basically, you know, a treatment in and of itself, and the omalizumab was treatment in and of itself. And we thought that length of time, the omalizumab would certainly no longer be affecting the multi-food OIT, and that we would have a good opportunity to compare the two treatments.
Okay, I think that's really fascinating. Do you have a sense, or are you able to share when all the participants will be have completed phase two?
Yeah, phase two will be complete in August of this year, and data will be cleaned and locked over the course of the fall. So hopefully by Quad AI meeting 2025, we will have those results to present.
It's like the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Like, you just stay tuned for the next one. Every year we're going to have something different. That's great. So if that's not enough, what does phase three of the OutMatch study entail?
Yeah, so stage three is looking at a very different idea. And the idea here is whether patients can begin eating a food under the protection of omalizumab or after receiving OIT, and how well they do over the next 1+ years in terms of their ability to incorporate that food into their diet. This is completely inconsistent with the product label. The product label does and will remain for protection against small accidental exposures. But we found that most people were actually able to begin eating the food and using this as sort of a analog of OIT, but doing it with dietary food rather than with, some sort of prescriptive product.
Okay. And will this, is it safe to assume this will not begin until all of the participants have completed phase two, or are some already starting on phase three?
Yeah, so everyone rolled into phase three, sequentially. So the first 60 who went to the open label extension went straight into phase three. Okay. Right now, most of the participants who went into stage two have entered stage three. Our last participants will be, finishing stage two this summer. So it'll be about a year after that before we'll have the full 1 year of stage three data to be able to look at the whole population. So many, many people have completed stage three, but we won't be reporting it for the whole population until the study's completed. We do hope, though, in the meantime, to have a smaller paper out that's going to look at those 60 people who went straight from omalizumab in the open label extension to stage three. And this is really fascinating data.
Okay. Speaking of, having the peer-reviewed manuscript available to read, do you know when or where we can read about the full stage one results? Where is it going to be published and when?
Yeah, so the full stage one results will be published online on the 25th of February. Mm-hmm. It will be published online at the start of my talk at 1:45 on Sunday afternoon, and then it will be published in print a little bit later in the month of March.
Okay. If I may ask, are you going to go straight from your presentation on Sunday afternoon at the Academy? Do you have press junkets lined up and things like that, or not so much?
We expect so. There's been a lot of press this week based just on the Genentech announcement of the FDA mm-hmm. approval, but we expect it's going to really, really expand once the paper comes out next week.
Yeah, I have no doubt. And that's why we're so thankful that you took the time to record this with us, because I'm sure you're going to be very busy. So speaking of, I know a lot of our listeners want to learn more about the FDA approval, which occurred on February 16th, where, as you mentioned several times, omalizumab is approved for the treatment of food allergies down to 1 year of age. It is approved for any food allergen, and dosing is based upon the patient weight and total serum IgE level. I encourage everybody to check out the dosing grid and the package insert. I'm sure we're going to learn a lot more about optimal use of this treatment, and people are going to use it in various ways. But do you have any thoughts on when this should be considered for clinical use?
Yeah, absolutely. And, the further, I got down the road of studying this drug, the more convinced I was that it had a real role in clinical use. And that's sort of begun to play out a little bit, looking honestly for patients who had food allergy and bad enough asthma to qualify for the drug. We've had many families decide to pay out of pocket so that they didn't have to wait for the FDA approval. Beyond that, now that it's approved and we're talking to patients about it, literally every day in clinic, I think a number of things are sort of sorting out in my mind as to who's most likely to choose to be treated. We do worry, as you mentioned, about insurance authorization. But aside from the high IgE, I don't think insurance can push back terribly hard on this because of the way the label's written. It's going to be very hard to deny this drug to people. So who are people I think may benefit the most? I think multi-food allergy is very important and something that I think is less amenable to OIT. And if we wanted to use, you know, FDA-approved product, we only have the peanut OIT for a limited age range. And then the more of the what I would call hard-to-avoid foods a patient is allergic to, I think the more appealing the drug. And the difference there to me is that my bet is the average patient who just has peanut allergy will choose to not be on the drug. Although there are certainly people who will. And I think the more foods you add to that, and especially if you add things like milk or egg into that patient's list, then I think the more appealing the drug will be. I think age will play a factor. And, you know, just in these last weeks leading up to this, I haven't had, I think, a single college age patient say they don't want the drug. And I think that we have also talked, I talked to four or five families yesterday with, say, 5 to 12-year-olds who are really doing well managing their food allergy. Again, they're mostly peanut and tree nuts, but we talk about the level of anxiety they have with their food allergy, you know, how much restriction it causes in their life, the whole concept of quality of life. And a lot of these families said, this is amazing, but I don't think we need it now, but we're certainly going to continue to reevaluate, and we definitely want him or her on it in college. So I think there's going to be scenarios like that that play out. Then the last thing, Dave, that I think will be the tipping point for a lot of families is whether you have the common comorbidities of asthma and allergic rhinitis. And, you know, we know it works well in asthma. It works amazingly well if you don't have that much asthma. And it's an amazing drug for allergic rhinitis. So if we have a kid who's, you know, doing pretty well with their peanut and tree nut avoidance and they're 14 or 15 and they want to have a little bit more freedom in their life, but they're also really find a major nuisance with their environmental allergies and would love to not be on as much of an inhaler for their asthma, I think this would be literally a tipping point for a lot of people saying, if I can get a shot every 2 weeks or every 4 weeks, have protection against my food allergy, and require a lot less medication to keep my asthma and allergic rhinitis under control. Families are describing it as sounds like a dream come true.
Oh, boy, that's wonderful perspective you just offered. I encourage all of our listeners to go back and listen to the last few minutes again and again, because I couldn't agree with you more. There's so many variables at play here with patient age, what they're allergic to, prior history, comorbidities. You know, this is shared decision making at its finest. And I chuckled because I've had the same conversations over the last few weeks of every single adolescent heading off to college it says, yes, sign me up. So this is great. You know, as we wrap up, and we want to be mindful of your time, but I would like to take the opportunity to just clarify some points of confusion that I've already heard from patients and their families. So if you're okay with it, let's maybe go through some key points here. Does treatment with omalizumab allow somebody to start eating their food allergen in their diet on a regular basis?
So theoretically, yes, and that's what stage three is meant to investigate. You know, right now, we're going to be taking a fairly hard line for following the package insert. But as we gather and publish more data on the introduction of foods, I think that this will be a common practice and one that may be really valuable and may allow some patients to use the medicine in more of a short-term way until they can introduce the food. And then as long as they maintain the food, maintain that desensitization and potentially drop the drug. So that's something that we are, you know, actively exploring and will be, you know, very careful about until we you know, gather more data about exactly how stage three has worked out.
Okay. If somebody starts treatment with omalizumab, does it offer protection immediately as soon as they get their first dose? And a follow-up question to that, do they still need to have access to epinephrine if they have food allergies?
Yeah, so the first part of the question is probably not, but it might. You know, we chose this 4 months for the study because we were confident that that would be enough time, although it might not have been quite enough, especially for the cashew. We did a study, though, about 10 years ago that looked at peanut allergic adults who either got one or two doses of omalizumab and then had a repeat peanut challenge. And we actually found that after getting only one or two doses, everyone had essentially their maximum level of protection. We challenged them again after 6 more months of treatment, and no one actually got better comparing the first 4 to 8 weeks to 6 months later. So it's another question that needs to be answered. Right now, we only have the data that we really have. That study we did before tells us something, but it was only 14 patients. It was sort of, you know, proving a concept, but not enough data to really make clinical recommendations from. And the second question you asked is yes, patients will be recommended in just as strong language as we always have to carry self-injectable epinephrine, even if they're being treated with omalizumab. And the idea there is that even if you're a good responder, there is some amount that may overwhelm the drug. And that amount might vary a fair amount from person to person. For that reason, the recommendation is strict avoidance and carry self-injectable epinephrine.
And this question has already come up in my own practice. Can you help clarify if somebody's experiencing an acute allergic reaction, does omalizumab treat that allergic reaction acutely, or should they still use their epinephrine, especially for anaphylaxis?
Yeah, no, it has no acute effect, certainly. So that would be a bad plan. We still need to rely on epinephrine for that immediate relief.
Okay. One last sort of common question I've been receiving. If you could offer just some brief thoughts on how does omalizumab differ from oral immunotherapy, especially in regard to risk, benefit, and the expected outcomes?
Well, you got another hour?
I know. I'm sorry.
Okay. So let's go through the straightforward part. Is that omalizumab is like all the allergy drugs we use, which work while you're on them and then have no effect once you're off them. We have this in the back of our mind, hope that the drug, if used in young children, could be disease modifying, but we don't know that. And right now, look at it as a drug that will be effective when you're on it, and then you'll lose any of the protection you had while you were being treated. Oral immunotherapy has more potential to be disease modifying, but still in most instances is going to be a very long-term treatment, possibly even a lifetime treatment, that carries more risk of adverse reactions, including significant allergic reactions, even in people who've been on it for an extended period of time. So we would think the omalizumab is going to be a lot more convenient, even if you don't like shots, you're only getting a shot every 2 or 4 weeks. That it probably is more acceptable for long-term use in that the dropout from oral immunotherapy is quite high, either because of adverse reactions or just too hard to stick with. It will be back again, Dave, to share decision-making. And that's why I'm, you know, what we should have done, because this study got to be monstrously large, is just stage one, just to do that. But I'm really happy stage two is in there, because we will be able to look specifically at the drugs head to head and answer that question with some data that we really don't have right now.
Yeah, I'm very curious as well. So, okay. Well, thank you. I thought that was a great summary. That did not take you nearly an hour. So, Dr. Wood, this is very exciting. And it really reminds me of when the LEAF trial was completed in 2015, and this was introduced to all of us. And it changed our approach to feeding infants and prevention strategies for food allergy. You've led such a long and distinguished career investigating various treatment options for food allergy. What does the approval of omalizumab for treating food allergies mean to you personally?
Well, my goal every research project I've done is to try to bring something to our patients. And that was, you know, even we were trying to define, you know, how do you interpret an IgE level and when do you do a food challenge? And this is a magnitude of significance greater than that, I think. But, you know, my forever goal has been, literally things that could be brought directly to our patients, things that every allergist would know about and be comfortable using. And the satisfaction there is actually being able to see this study go from an idea to a really rich collaboration to FDA approval. And I said earlier, it seems like a really long time to start talking about a study and actually get it done. But to actually have these two things happen simultaneously, the paper come out and the FDA approval happening within 10 days of each other, is really pretty remarkable and a credit to the whole collaborative network who has organized and pulled off what is, you know, really a very difficult study. And special thanks to these patients and families, some of whom had to fly here for every visit, every 2 weeks for years. And their willingness to participate was really remarkable because this is the hardest study we've ever asked in the world of food allergy anyway, patients to participate in.
Oh, that's great. Perhaps one day we can have some of those participants on the podcast even to discuss their experience and what you mentioned, what they went through during the pandemic and starting over again. It's just so, so remarkable. Well, lastly, I would be remiss if I didn't mention to our audience that Dr. Wood was our very first guest on the podcast that you're listening to when he was serving as president of the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, Immunology in 2018. And I have to admit, I still recall how nervous I was during that first recording. It was my first podcast as a host. And yet here we are, and we've made it to 110 episodes. I think I found my groove, but I'm going to let you be the judge of that. How do you think this one went compared to our last recording?
They were both perfect, Dave. And of the 110 episodes, I'm sure I've listened to 108, and they're all so excellent and valuable to our membership, and everyone involved in the world of allergy benefits from these podcasts.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, and to our audience, that is what's called fishing for a cheap, applause there. So thank you, Dr. Wood. I appreciate it. Thank you again for taking the time to be with us. I know how busy you are right now, and this is just remarkable with all the great press surrounding this. This was a great conversation. I know it's going to be beneficial to our listeners. Is there anything else that you would like to add?
No, I think we covered it.
Okay. Well, thank you again.
All right. It's been my pleasure, Dave. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to today's episode. Please visit www.aaai.org for show notes and any pertinent links from today's conversation. If you like the show, please take a moment to subscribe to our podcast through Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify so you can receive new episodes in the future. Thank you again for listening.